In Washington, gray is blue. In Charlotte, the ex-mayor will now be wearing orange. And did I tell you that this podcast can use some green? From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, 'cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 21 of The Political Junkie. It's been a week of scandal around the country. The mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina, resigned his office just hours after his arrest on corruption charges. The mayor of Washington, D.C., stuck in a scandal over money that illegally wound up in his campaign coffers 4 years ago, was defeated in Tuesday's primary. We'll have reports from both cities in this week's show. And the deadline for signing up for the Affordable Care Act has passed, sort of. Now all that's left for Obamacare is the politics of it all. But first, as always, a trivia question. Republicans need a net gain of 6 Senate seats to win a majority in November. When was the last time a party won at least that many seats in a midterm election to shift control of the Senate? Send your answer to Ken at KenRudinPolitics.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's Ken at KenRudinPolitics.com. Last week's question was, President Obama has now met with two popes, Pope Francis last week and Pope Benedict XVI in 2009. Who was the first president to have met with more than one reigning pope? The answer, George W. Bush. He also met with Benedict 3 times in 2007 and 2008. He also met twice with John Paul II in 2002 and 2004. And the randomly selected winner to the trivia question? Tim McGaw of East Fallowfield, Pennsylvania. Tim gets blessed with the button. And last week's scuttlebutton puzzle. The first button read, Hardy Myers for state representative. The next read, Mrs. Haar, that's Charlene Haar, for the Senate in South Dakota. The third button said the exact same thing, Mrs. Haar for the Senate. Trisha Jones of Ann Arbor, Michigan knew that translated to Hardy Har Har. A Hanna-Barbera cartoon character, yes, as well as Ralph Cramden's famously sarcastic laugh on The Honeymooners.
Ha ha, Hardy Har Har!
To the moon, Trisha Jones. You can keep up with the latest scuttlebutton puzzles, trivia, and the latest installment of our March Madness contest at krpoliticaljunkie.com. The White House says good news for the Affordable Care Act. Some 7 million people signed up by the March 31st deadline. It's not really a set-in-stone deadline, though. People who tried to sign up but had problems will get an extension. Great news when you consider all the problems the site had from the start. But Republicans in Congress say it may not be good news at all. Premiums are almost certainly going to go up, and customers may not be able to keep the doctor they want. But let's leave the cost and the web problems and the logistics to someone else. Let's talk about the important stuff, politics. And let's talk about that with Janet Hook, political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Janet, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Glad to be here, Ken.
First, let's talk a little bit about the deadline that just passed. The White House seems very pleased. What does it mean?
Well, they were pleased because a target was set and a target was met. Probably the biggest problem for them would have been if they'd fallen really short. I think the downside risk was greater than any benefit they get from actually meeting the deadline. However, I got to say, as you mentioned, it's a kind of a squishy deadline. There was such a jam at the deadline. Many people are like college students. They wait to the last minute to do what they have to do. And so the website crashed. And so they gave a little grace period for people who'd started the process before March 31st that they could have some time afterwards to finish the process. So it's an important milestone in the march towards implementing it, but it's certainly not the end of the political debate.
No, that's clearly the case, and obviously Republicans still think they have a winning issue in November. The ACA, the Affordable Care Act, polls show it's still unpopular around much of the country, and there's a debate going on in the Democratic Party about whether to stop being defensive and go all out to praise it, or to say that we'll keep the good stuff and fix the bad stuff.
That's right. Now, there is this other poll finding that the Democrats are latching on to. While the Affordable Care Act is now much more, there's much more disapproval than approval of the act itself. A lot of polls show, though, that people don't favor repealing it entirely. So what a lot of Democrats are hoping to do is to flip the debate of, okay, you may not like the ACA as it stands, and we're working to fix it, but you really don't want to repeal it, and that's what my Republican opponent wants to do. That's not exactly a full-throated defense of the act. I mean, it's kind of like that's water over the dam. I think that all along, the Democrats and President Obama haven't done a particularly good job of selling the law for its benefits.
On the campaign trail, we've seen many Democrats in tough bids for re-election, such as Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick of Arizona. They've not hesitated to criticize what they don't like about it, but also how they want to improve it.
It's why she blew the whistle on the disastrous healthcare website, calling it stunning ineptitude, and worked to fix it. She fought to hold insurance companies accountable so they can't deny coverage for pre-existing conditions or drop coverage when you get sick. Ann Kirkpatrick, seeing what's wrong, doing what's right.
Janet, a lot of Democrats are in that position.
Yes, and I think that it's kind of actually for Democrats in swing districts or states that are where Obama's unpopular, it's actually not a bad thing for them to be able to say, well, I thought the rollout was terrible, and I stood up and I told President Obama that I thought it was terrible. It gives them a way to distance themselves from the president. They're just talking about how the law or the rollout was problematic.
Now, Republicans think, for their part, the Republicans think, you know, there's no reason to change the script at all. Obamacare is wrong and must be repealed. Paul Ryan's budget blueprint that came out this week calls for exactly that. And they also point to the recent result in the Florida House race, saying that voters don't like the law.
Right. There's a dispute about whether that's exactly what the message of the special election was. It was obviously a very central issue in that Florida House race. The Democrats, understandably, are looking more carefully to figure out what was the problem. And they have concluded, and I don't think this is just spin, I think they genuinely have concluded that there isn't a better health care message for them. They saw problems in turnout. And the depressed Democratic turnout could be indirectly related to health care because people, Democrats, aren't as excited about Obama as they once were. So I don't think as a result of Florida, you'll see a big turn of Democrats away from the basic message, which is fix it, don't kill it. But you do see them focusing much, much more on efforts to maximize turnout and to motivate the Democratic base.
Away from the campaign trail, there was a group of centrist Democratic senators. Some of them up for re-election, like Mark Begich of Alaska, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. And there are others such as Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota and Joe Manchin of West Virginia who are not up. But they plan to introduce a set of principles to fix the problems and strengthen the law. My question is, does Harry Reid really want to have a debate on the Senate floor about Obamacare right before the election?
Simple answer to that question, which is no. I don't think that any legislation of that sort is going to be brought to the Senate floor. First of all, because it won't pass. Secondly, because it'll just, you know, open up a whole can of worms. And I think that the Democrats' leading strategy for coping with the problems with Obamacare on the campaign trail and in the Senate is to change the subject. They've been talking a lot about broader economic issues, and to the extent that they do talk about health care, they tie it back into the idea that, well, we're the defenders of the middle class, and if you repeal health care, it's the middle class that's going to suffer.
They're focusing on pocketbook issues like increasing the minimum wage or eliminating the pay gap between men and women, trying to put Republicans on the defensive for a change.
Right, and that's kind of what members of both parties often say, that all elections are really about the economy. And this one in particular, what with the economic recovery not humming along as quickly as anyone would like. And I do think that the Democrats feel like they're on much stronger ground when they're advocating for extending unemployment benefits and advocating for raising the minimum wage. Even if those things don't pass, they do like talking about them and voting on them.
Well, we are talking about the election. I know it's only April, but the Republicans are convinced that Obamacare is the issue. The Democrats are convinced that maybe perhaps the pocketbook issues are the way to succeed in November. Is there such a thing as who's right so far?
Well, I think they're both right. I mean, I think everybody's arguing their case. And, you know, I think that one thing has to do with how those issues play with each party's base. I mean, one of the reasons why Republicans are harping on the health care law isn't because not necessarily because they think that the Democrat is vulnerable, but because it really galvanizes Republicans. And at a time when the Republican Party is split on a lot of things, they all agree in their criticism of Obamacare. And so that's a good base motivator for them. And the same thing with, you know, issues like the minimum wage. It's not clear how these issues play with swing voters. They're both sides are counting on their base motivating campaign to also affect swing voters. But midterm really elections really are about getting the base out.
So really, whether it reaches the Senate floor or the House floor for a vote is not so much the issue as much as it is exciting the base.
That's right. That's right. The Republicans really are going to the bank on this because a lot of issues that they might have pursued are probably going to fall by the wayside. Like, maybe they would have considered doing immigration reform, but it's just a really bad issue for them in an election year, and they don't want to distract from their focus on criticizing the health care law.
Janet Hook is a political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. You can follow her on Twitter at HookJan. Janet, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Stay tuned for the 2014 version of The Culture of Corruption. It's time for This Week in Political History. This week we go back to 1987. The Reagan presidency was nearing its end, and the battle in the Republican Party to succeed him was going full steam ahead. Most of the attention was on two GOP giants, George Herbert Walker Bush, the incumbent vice president, and Bob Dole, the Senate minority leader. But one candidate was hoping to sell himself as the ideological heir to Ronald Reagan. That was Jack Kemp, the conservative nine-term congressman from the suburbs of Buffalo, New York. Before his political life, Kemp was quarterback of the Buffalo Bills, as well as the San Diego Chargers. He may not have had the name recognition or money of Bush or Dole, but his supporters argued he had a message the others lacked.
The fact is, from quarterbacking the Buffalo Bills to league championships, to 17 years of leadership in the Congress, to co-authoring the historic tax cuts of the 1980s, Jack Kemp has been the captain of every team he's ever played on.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Jack Kemp. How are you?
Jack Kemp. If he wins, we all win.
On April 6, 1987, Kemp launched his bid for the Republican presidential nomination.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's a better way. There's a more confident way. And that's why we're here. America must have a vision for the future that includes victory. A victory for the idea that there is nothing wrong with America that cannot be fixed.
Charlie Black is chairman of Prime Policy Group, a public affairs firm associated with Burson Marsteller. Back in 1987, he was a top Kemp strategist. Charlie, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Before we go any further, just tell us about the essence about Jack Kemp.
Well, Jack was a man of ideas. He was a charismatic leader and speaker. Achieved an awful lot getting ideas and policies passed through Congress, even though he wasn't on some of the relevant committees. And he contributed perhaps the most famous idea of the Reagan Revolution, which was the across-the-board tax cuts that President Reagan passed in 1981. It was actually Jack who wrote that bill originally, and it was Jack who sold Ronald Reagan on the concept of cutting taxes to grow the economy.
Tell us a little bit about the obstacles facing Kemp as he headed into the 88 battle for the nomination.
Well, the biggest obstacle was he just was a congressman. He represented one district, as you pointed out, in upstate New York. He had never run or won statewide, so he didn't have a big financial base running against the sitting vice president and the majority leader of the Senate. They could attract more of the large donor money. Jack was the best campaigner and the best speaker in the group, but he had to raise his money through direct mail, small donations, and had to hustle around the early states in the process and try to out-campaign them. And I must say, he did a great job of campaigning. He didn't win in the end, but the reason wasn't as much Dole or Bush as it was Pat Robertson, who entered the race and peeled off a good portion of the social conservative vote that Kemp might otherwise have gotten.
Clearly, Pat Robertson had this great organization going for him in Iowa, but he didn't in New Hampshire. You would think that maybe in New Hampshire was a good opportunity for Kemp to break out.
Well, you know what? That was the strategy, Ken, was that we were hoping that Kemp could place third in Iowa. We expected Dole to win, but, you know, Dole, Bush, and some combination to be 1 and 2. And if Jack could finish third in Iowa, that would be enough to make the cut. And he had campaigned hard and effectively in New Hampshire. Then the goal was to finish second in New Hampshire, expected Bush to win there. And if he could pass Dole in New Hampshire, then we could declare it a two-person race, Bush versus Kemp. However, Robertson was so strong in Iowa that he finished second. He defeated Bush and Kemp finished fourth. And that took away a lot of the momentum that we had in New Hampshire.
One complaint I remember hearing about Kemp was that he was too intellectual. You don't hear that about too many politicians today, but he would talk about the nuances of an economic policy. I remember once I was in Iowa, I guess it was early 88, maybe it was late 87, and I remember a farmer complaining about him talking about the gold standard. I mean, he was a man of ideas, clearly, but they didn't always resonate with voters.
Well, some of them didn't, but Jack had a sort of a comprehensive economic policy plan, and he thought, you know, sound money going back to the gold standard or some kind of a basket of commodities was a proper policy. So he would sometimes talk too much about those issues that weren't directly on the voters' minds. But he also was a good campaigner and did get across the messages that he wanted about tax cuts and growing the economy and continuing the Reagan revolution. He just sometimes talked a little too much.
Over the past several decades, many have identified Kemp as someone they looked up to. I remember Paul Ryan, I think, when he was first announced as the Romney running mate, would constantly cite him as somebody he always looked up to. We keep hearing that Jack Kemp was a different kind of Republican. What does that mean?
Well, here's what it meant. Jack was the original advocate of Republican outreach, that leaders and candidates should campaign in all neighborhoods among all ethnic groups and present a message that was just as good for African Americans and Latinos and other minority groups as it was for white suburbanites. And Jack knew how to campaign there. Jack was a member and a leader in a labor union in the NFL. And so he would gladly go into union halls and try to convince the union members that free trade was a good policy. He was great at outreach, and it was a moral obligation to him as well as something the party needed to do to become the majority. And so a lot of people, like Paul Ryan and other candidates, learned that approach from Jack.
Are there any Jack Kemps in the Republican Party today?
Well, I think Paul Ryan's a good example. I think Bobby Jindal is a good example. I think you have a number of our prominent governors who follow the Kemp approach. John Kasich was a contemporary of Kemp's, the governor of Ohio, and has always been a good populist campaigner in the same mold. But I think Jack's impact was that every Republican leader and every president and presidential candidate since his career has advocated for policies that lift all Americans up and for taking our message into every community, not writing off any group or not presenting policies that leave anybody behind.
Charlie Black is a longtime Republican strategist who was a key advisor to Jack Kemp's presidential campaign in 1988. It was on this week in 1987 that Jack Kemp declared his candidacy for president. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Ken. Thank you.
One of the issues that brought Democrats to power in 2006 and 2008 was corruption. With Tom DeLay, Mark Foley, Duke Cunningham, and Jack Abramoff in the headlines, Nancy Pelosi went around the country decrying the Republicans' culture of corruption. Here she is on election night 2006, when Democratic gains made her the next Speaker of the House.
The American people voted to restore integrity and honesty in Washington, D.C. And the Democrats intend to lead the most honest, most open, and most ethical Congress in history.
The headlines, though, have not been too kind to Democrats in the last few weeks. Three Democratic state senators in California have been suspended from the legislature. This week, one of them, Secretary of State candidate Leland Yee, was arrested for taking bribes and firearms trafficking. This cost Democrats their supermajority in the state Senate. The week before, the Rhode Island Speaker of the House resigned suddenly. This was a day after federal and state agents raided his home and office, leaving with boxes and bags of evidence. In Charlotte, North Carolina, Mayor Patrick Cannon resigned just hours after his arrest, accused of taking bribes from undercover FBI agents in a years-long investigation. And in Washington, D.C., an ongoing look into the funding of Mayor Vincent Gray's campaign 4 years ago had one immediate result. Gray was decisively defeated in Tuesday's primary. All of these politicians are Democrats. These scandals may not get the same national attention as, say, Tom DeLay or Duke Cunningham got, but it's not good news for a party that's already on the defensive for 2014. We're going to start with Jim Morrill, a reporter with the Charlotte Observer. Jim, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Ken, it's nice to be with you. Thanks.
What is Mayor, or should I say former Mayor Cannon, charged with? I know the investigation has been going on for years, but Cannon was only elected mayor last November.
Yeah, it's only been 5 months, Ken, and he was arrested, and there's no indictment yet, which is another story, but there's a 42-page affidavit from FBI agents that alleged that he took bribes up to $20,000 on 5 or 6 different occasions, and he also took a trip to Las Vegas that was paid for by the undercover agent under the guise of scouting some economic development prospects here, where he also allegedly put money in his pocket. And the most recent one was in the mayor's office itself at City Hall, where FBI agents say they slipped him $20,000 in a satchel and left it there for him.
So wait a second. So he was taking envelopes of cash in his office. It sounds Agnew-esque.
It does, only it was a briefcase. It was a fossil briefcase, but it was in the office. And in fact, there was quite a long dialogue between the agent and the mayor about how best to account for the agent having left it in the office in case there were cameras showing the scene. So, yeah, it was pretty stunning for the city.
Explain to me, I understand that he's been under investigation for several years, but he only was elected mayor 5 months ago. What?
Well, the investigation did start in 2010, according to the FBI affidavit. Now, he didn't take his first payoff, according to the affidavit, until the beginning of last year.
Who was he in 2010?
He was a mayor pro tem, the highest-ranking city council member. And he was also the longest-serving city council member. He was first elected back in the 90s. At age 26, so he'd spent almost half his life on city council or at City Hall.
So this is an investigation that went on 4 years and finally culminated, unfortunately for the people in Charlotte, after his election.
Exactly, and that's what a lot of people were asking. If they knew this was going on, if the FBI even suspected it was going on, why let him be elected? There's no answer for that yet, although people say that they were trying to build up a case, trying to prove a pattern. And he didn't allegedly take the most money until he was in office. And so, you know, it's a bigger fish, too, when he's the mayor.
For the longest time, people were talking about him as somebody who had a very strong, very bright political future.
You know, I don't know that people saw him going places in the same way they saw former Mayor Anthony Fox, who's now the U.S. Secretary of Transportation. I think people expected Mayor Cannon to be in office for almost as long as he wants. This is a very Democratic city. The demographics are all in favor of Democrats. He probably could have stayed in office indefinitely. So it came as a shock to people. I mean, once the news came out, once the initial shock was over, people began to say, well, I told you so, or there were some suspicions about his character all along. But I don't think anybody expected things quite like this.
Obviously, he is innocent until proven guilty, but the fact that he resigned almost immediately may say something about the case.
Well, it probably says that he got advice from his lawyer to do that, if nothing else, because big money now is on a plea agreement. He was scheduled to be indicted in the middle of the week, and instead that got postponed by a month or so. So the speculation is that he and his lawyer are negotiating a plea agreement.
You know, we talked about whether he had a political future or not, and we have seen mayors of Charlotte in the past move up. The current governor, Pat McCrory, former mayor of Charlotte, Harvey Gantt, who ran for the Senate twice, former mayor of Charlotte, Sue Myrick, former congresswoman, was mayor of Charlotte. And in some cases, we have seen being mayor of Charlotte could be a stepping stone for higher office.
Yeah, you know, every mayor back to 1980, I think, has run for higher office, and it's only recently that they've actually begun to succeed. As you mentioned, the Pat McCrory is now the governor. Anthony Fox is the transportation secretary. Before that, it was kind of a dry spell. People did run for office, but usually didn't make it. But, you know, you mentioned the culture of corruption, and Republicans have been able to talk about Democrats in North Carolina in the context of a culture of corruption for a number of years. One of our former speakers of the House was indicted and served time in jail for corruption.
We have seen the political tide turn in North Carolina. We saw the Democrats have a great year in 2008. Kay Hagan was elected to the Senate. Barack Obama won the state in the presidential race. But then in 2010, the Republicans took the state legislature. 2012, Mitt Romney carried the state. And now 2014, Senator Hagan's in big trouble. Do we think that the scandal, the corruption scandal in Charlotte, could resonate statewide?
You know, Republicans have been pretty careful about bringing it up, although there's a poster in the town of Greensboro, which is an hour and a half from here. It has a big picture of the mayor swimming in a pile of money. So it's pretty obvious that some people are making something of it. But to this point, Republicans haven't really tried to make a whole lot about it and tie it to the Senate race in particular.
Jim Morrill is a reporter with the Charlotte Observer. He can be found on Twitter at Jim Morrill. Thanks a lot, Jim.
Thank you, Ken. Pleasure.
And now closer to home. Last week, we had WAMU reporter Patrick Madden on the show to set up Tuesday's Democratic primary between Mayor Vincent Gray, who had been under a cloud of scandal, and his field of opponents. On Tuesday, City Council member Muriel Bowser took the nomination. Patrick, thanks for coming all the way back to the studios of WAMU.
It was a long haul.
You know, you look like you haven't had much sleep. Is that possible?
I'm in the sleep deprivation stage right now.
Well, fortunately, this show will put a lot of people to sleep. So it'll be excellent. Patrick, it's not a stretch to say that Gray's ethical problems are what caused his defeat.
Yeah, I mean, clearly this race turned when federal prosecutors alleged that the mayor knew about this illegal shadow campaign that helped his previous campaign back in 2010.
Of course, he hasn't been officially charged with anything, but there are people close to him who have been.
Right. So what happened basically is you had this big city contractor named Jeff Thompson, and he held a couple really lucrative contracts worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And back in 2010, when Mayor Gray wasn't mayor, but a city council chairman.
First running for mayor
against then-mayor Adrian Fenty. Jeff Thompson basically wanted to support Gray without Fenty finding out. Thompson set up, with the help of others, a way to create this sort of shadow campaign, $600,000 of his own money that was used to help Gray's get out the vote efforts. And we're all sort of finding out about all the dirty details right now.
Insinuations and hints about corruption in Mayor Gray's 2010 campaign have been around for a while now. But how did Muriel Bowser be the one to benefit from this? I mean, Mayor Gray had seven challengers on the ballot.
Right. As you mentioned, this has been around for a while. There's multiple people associated with Gray's campaigns have pleaded guilty over this three-year investigation. Bowser was able to capitalize on the really big bombshell allegation, which is prosecutors saying that Gray knew about it, basically because she was probably the most viable candidate who could beat Gray. So all of the folks who may have supported other candidates but really did not want Gray to be reelected as mayor threw their support behind Bowser. And that's why if you charted her support in the polls, she was with the pack and then just skyrocketed up.
Yeah, once upon a time, we thought that because he had so many opponents, Gray and his leading challenger would be much closer, but it wasn't even close on Tuesday.
That was actually the biggest surprise for most of us, was just it wasn't close. Bowser, you know, won by double digits, which no one expected.
Washington, D.C. has now had six mayors, and four of them were defeated in their bid for reelection. What does it say about the politics here in the nation's capital?
It's fascinating because before Gray, it was Adrian Fenty. People liked him, thought he was doing a good job. They kicked him out because apparently they thought he was kind of a jerk. Mayor Gray, everyone thinks he's doing a good job. You can see the construction cranes, school test scores are up, violent crime's down. They kicked him out because of this sort of ongoing ethical cloud that has been sort of hovering over his administration. What does it say? I guess it says that district residents are impatient.
Jim Morrill in Charlotte, North Carolina, talked about the culture of corruption and how that what's going on in Charlotte may or may not resonate statewide. Scandal in Washington, D.C. is not a new phenomenon.
It's not a new phenomenon, but it really has ramped up in recent years. We've had, I mean, I can go through just the council members who have been kicked off and pleaded guilty to various crimes. One was taking bribes from an undercover FBI agent who would put the money in a Washington Redskins mug. Another guy was stealing money from it was basically supposed to go to kids' sports teams. He was putting it in his pocket. So we've had multiple issues with corruption in the city. And, of course, as you mentioned, it goes back a while.
Patrick Madden is a reporter for radio station WAMU here in D.C. His Twitter handle, as the kids call it these days, is @Patrick_Madden. Patrick, get some sleep.
I will. Thank you, Ken.
I appreciate it. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. To sign up for our weekly newsletter and to check out bonus junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttle button puzzles, you can visit us on the web at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And please make sure you enter our March Madness competition to determine the 2016 GOP presidential nominee. Don't forget to send your comments, questions, and cash, and we do need cash, to ken@kenrudinpolitics.com. You can find The Political Junkie on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and krpoliticaljunkie.com. And we're on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio for all your listening needs. We need your ratings and reviews to get new listeners to find us, so please help us out. Our producer is A.D. Quigg. Kristen Sorensen is our associate producer. Douglas Bell is our web producer. And Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.